If there's one thing that we can all do to help reverse climate change is to cut our consumption of animal products.
Welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. I'm Bruce Edwards. In this episode, how changing our food consumption habits can dramatically reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
One simple rule being no animal products before dinner. That's much more than cutting our flights or buying an electric car.
Wow.
I am Nicoletta Vattini, and I work in the IMF's Independent Evaluation Office.
While efforts to mitigate climate change have focused mainly on burning less fossil fuels, recent research by the UN's Panel on Climate Change shows that what we eat and how we produce it has an even greater impact on the environment and on public health in general. The report says reforms in crop and livestock activities could potentially mitigate up to a third of all greenhouse gas emissions. IMF economist Nicoletta Vattini studies the environmental impact of the agri-food sector. Her latest article, titled Reaping What We Sow, is published in the December 2019 issue of Finance and Development magazine. So what is the impact on the environment of our eating habits as compared to, say, our driving habits?
Our eating habits matter a lot for the environment. In fact, it's probably the sector that most impacts the planet. Numbers show very clearly that what we eat and how we produce it and how it gets to us have a much bigger carbon footprint, for example, than the sum of all ships, all trucks, all cars, all trains, all airplanes on Earth.
Wow.
It's huge. And within this, cows, either eaten or milked, have an outsized impact. And this is not just because they emit methane, which is a super potent greenhouse gas, but because they eat much more food than they actually produce in the end for us. And so that requires the clearing of pristine forests like the Amazons for pasture and a lot of farmland just to grow food to feed them. This process altogether releases massive amounts of CO2.
So is meat the most harmful thing that we eat in terms of carbon emissions?
Correct. In fact, eating one serving of beef, about half a pound or 200 grams of beef, like a burger, is equivalent to driving a mid-sized European car for over 200 miles.
Wow. One
serving of beef also leads to acres of deforestation, with loss on a daily basis of over hundreds of species of both plants and animals. And it also leads to the contamination, both chemical and biological, of over 3,000 liters of water. That's about 2 months of showers for one burger.
Wow, that is absolutely incredible. So what, given all the damage on the environment by the foods that we consume, what is the real cost of those foods that we eat?
Well, the cost would depend on the type of food that we're eating. A plant-based diet has very little cost for the environment, and it's actually healthy. A diet that is predominantly based on animal products is very expensive. Now, let me give you one example. In the book Meatonomics, Simon Robinson did a calculation, for example, for a Big Mac. A Big Mac at present in the United States is priced at $5.60. But if you were to include into the true cost of the burger, all the environmental, health, and other impacts producing that burger has on people and the environment, that cost would actually run up to $12.
Really?
The same calculation has been made for milk. A gallon would go from the current $3 to $3.50 to $9.
Wow. So in the article, you refer to the industrialization of the agriculture business that is accelerating
or intensifying carbon emissions in the atmosphere.
That's correct.
But you know, that move away from the smaller farms to the more industrial farms, is it not driven by the demand for more food products?
The industrialization of agriculture has actually been driven by a couple of big trends. The first trend has been a technological advance. This happens in most sectors of economic production. For agriculture, that basically coincided with new technologies on chemical inputs for pesticides and herbicides, the use of mechanization through machines like large tractors that would just spare people from having to do the manual work. The second trend that led the transition to the industrial way of conducting agriculture has been government subsidies. So after World War II, in a lot of countries, governments were worried that there wouldn't be enough food on the table for people. And what they did, they tried to support food production through systems of food subsidies. Now, these food subsidies, however, at that time and currently do not match recommended production of crops. In other words, nutrition recommendations say you should eat a diet made of ABC, but the subsidies predominantly go to D, which is a food that perhaps you shouldn't eat much of or at all. And these two phenomena have basically led to a really dramatic consolidation of the sector, and large agribusiness have swallowed up a lot of family farms, a process that continues today. So the sector is very concentrated. Now, in this new world, these companies, of course, go mostly for profits and volumes, and that has meant that nature has really become an input, a widget into factory system, and that includes animals. And therefore, there are very perverse effect on the environment and on health from having highly industrialized the process.
Mm. So would you say that globalization has accelerated environmentally harmful agriculture?
We tend to think of globalization in a positive sense, as a positive force, and it certainly is in many respects, but in agriculture it probably isn't. What has happened in the food system front is that globalization has allowed people to trade food internationally to volumes and rhythms that are almost inconceivable. You can find, you know, Quebecois eating a pineapple crated 2 days before on the Ivory Coast, or a family in a restaurant in Shenzhen being served beef that has been brought in from deforested areas in the Amazons. These phenomena are, of course, perhaps nice from a consumer point of view to have access and be able to indulge, you know, in fresh things grown very far lands. But when you look at them from a planetary perspective, from the boundaries of production that each ecosystem has and, you know, possesses, they're extremely detrimental. And so these trends cannot be sustained, especially with population expected to grow by several billions by the end of these centuries, and people all over the world, especially in developing countries, trying to catch up to the Western-style diet that others already enjoy. Mm.
So in the article, you speak of this great food transition or the great food transformation. What is that exactly?
The great food transformation is the transition that is needed in the agri-food sector to make sure that food systems are sustainable while ensuring that there is enough food for all around the planet, and for current generations and future generations, and also make sure that that food is nutritious. To make it happen, we need to work on two endpoints, sustainable supply, so producing in a way that we stay within the planetary boundaries, and two, healthy diets, to make sure that people eat what they need and the amount of various vitamins, nutrients, and fibers that are recommended by science, but they not exceed them, because that would lead to overproduction and either someone falling short or the planet not being able to bear those rhythms of production.
So how do you incentivize people to move towards that when all these harmful foods environmentally harmful foods are so cheap and abundant in so many countries around the world.
The good thing about redressing food systems is that there is a divine coincidence between saving people's health and saving the planet. So sustainable eating habits are also healthy eating habits. What needs to be done is to convey the message to people that the way they feed themselves is unhealthy and is bad for them. It is also bad for the planet. Now, luckily, there's a lot of developments in the sector at the moment. There are entire generations, the millennials, the Gen Z generations, that are already autonomously choosing to shift, to more plant-based diets, more sustainable diets. They have an eye, and this comes up over and over again in consumer surveys run on retail food and beverages, for transparency, health, and safety of the products, humane treatment of animals, and sustainability of production. Mm.
So there is a whole industry, a huge industry behind our eating habits today. How do you see these companies, companies that are selling meat, distributing meat, how do you see them transitioning into a healthier food environment?
It's a bit like the fossil fuel industry or the energy industry. A lot of these big corporations are already invested in the new generation food. So they have stakes in joint ventures on agri-tech that proposes sustainable methods of agriculture. They have stakes in the production of protein alternatives to meat. And they're very well positioned to start, hit the ground running and be aggressively in those markets when those markets come to full force. And unfortunately, as of yet, they don't have the full incentives from government policies. In other words, they keep receiving subsidies for doing the wrong thing, and that they don't receive any subsidies from doing the right thing. If those subsidies were to be switched by governments, then, of course, they would have all the incentives aligned to do this transition themselves. Other things that can help, and I mentioned this in my work, have to do with regulations. Regulation is very important because you cannot fix markets often just with taxes and subsidies and educational campaigns. And regulation go in the area of agriculture to regulation of land, regulation of retailing practice, regulation of marketing practicing, so that, people are shown where the good food is in the supermarket. And at the same time, regulation to allow that the startups and the new version of food making have an easy life in entry markets. And I want to make one example there. There's a product that is coming to the market. It's already been in the making for decades, which is lab-grown meat, which is real meat. It's made from cells of animals, which are, extracted and a little piece of flesh, and then they're grown in a lab, and they can save, up to 90-95% of all the resources that are usually involved in meat production, from water to, CO2 to land, etc. Now, of course, some countries are giving these startups a difficult time in entering their markets, and they don't allow them to call the meat meat. They don't allow it to be called clean meat, which in fact, it is, because it's safe of antibiotics, it's safe of a lot of the pathogens that are found in meat, in actual animals. Changes to these parameters of legislation can make a terrific difference in shifting, markets and making the great food transformation happen.
In terms of international institutions like the IMF and the World Bank and other international financial institutions, what do you think their role is in trying to influence this transition?
This international organization have a big role to play. In fact, some of these organizations are already very active in these areas from different angles. I mean, the World Bank has done tremendous work on climate smart agriculture for developing countries. Has studied together with the Food and Agriculture Organization things like emissions from land or emissions from animal agriculture. The OECD has very deep analysis on these sectors. more can be done. And certainly, since these incentives that I talk about, this nudging, goes at the heart of macroeconomic policies, you can think of going to countries and advise them or think together about instruments that could be used to correct these behaviors, which are both socially and ecologically harmful. The fund, for example, but also many other institutions have a very clear and very developed agenda on carbon tax. One could equivalently think of a methane tax or a tax for nitrous oxide. Let's remember the numbers. Methane is a greenhouse gas, which is 86 times more powerful than CO2.
Wow.
Over a 20-year span. And in fact, a lot of people think that if we could deal with reducing methane emissions, we would probably meet the 1.5 target. If we completely abandon fossil fuels today, so we correct the CO2 emissions today, we don't get a signal in the atmosphere before many decades. And so really, there is a lot of logic and a lot of merit in thinking about addressing the food system, perhaps before than the energy system, to arrive at our one or stay within our 1.5 target.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Nicoletta Battini is a senior economist in the IMF's Independent Evaluation Office and studies the environmental impacts of the agri-food sector. Her latest article, titled Reaping What We Sow, is published in the December 2019 issue of Finance and Development magazine. You can read the article online at imf.org/FND or download the Finance and Development app to read it on your mobile device. And if you like this podcast, look for us on Spotify or your favorite podcast app. Just search for IMF Podcasts. You can also follow us on Twitter at IMF_podcast. Thanks for listening.